This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. We've got a very varied program this hour. In the first half, we'll be talking with a scholar from Southern California about early sketches of Nevada County life, of Northern California life from 1851 and 52. And in the second half, talking with two local novelists about the intricacies of getting your novel published, whether you're a beginner or really quite well-known. The first guest I've got is Thomas Blackburn, who's a professor emeritus of anthropology at California State Polytechnic in Pomona and author of many books on California Indians, especially on the Chumash of Southern California, but also ranging up and down the state. I probably wouldn't have known about this book, but a friend who used to live in Nevada County and has since moved to Southern California recommended it to me, and as soon as I saw it, I could see it was something that I very much wanted to share with Booktown listeners. So welcome to Booktown, Professor Blackburn.
Thank you.
The book is called An Artist's Portfolio, The California Sketches of Henry B. Brown from 1851 and 1852. He was a person who spent very little time in California, really. That period was about it. But he did some amazing work in that time, and some of it has been reproduced over the years, but a lot of this is essentially new material to most people. How did you come upon it? How did you decide to do this?
Well, it's a very long, involved story. I'll try to keep it fairly short here, but basically I've been aware of some of Brown's drawings for many years because some of them have been reproduced several times, and it was obvious that he was a very fine artist, but only a few of his drawings were known because they had been scattered around so much. I knew that the Bancroft had quite a number, but unfortunately most of those are very rough sketches, preliminary. They're very sketchy sketches, to put it mildly. But I happened to, you know, serendipity plays a big part in our lives, and I happened to be at the Huntington Library several years ago and was looking through a loosely folder detailing some of the recent acquisitions, and I ran across the one showing that they had just purchased about 50 of Brown's drawings from an estate. And I was very excited because, as I said, I knew about Brown and had admired what the work that I had seen of him. And so anyway, I asked to look at them and was delighted to discover that some of these were original drawings, some of which I had seen only in rather poor reproductions from photographs at the Bancroft. And so this got me interested in Brown again, and I wanted to compare the Bancroft and Huntington drawings. And then I was also aware that there was some at the John Carter Brown Library in Providence, Rhode Island, as well as at the Peabody Museum at Harvard in Boston, in Massachusetts. So this is sort of how I got started on it and doing research on Brown, and got a chance to finally see most of his drawings from California, which are, and I was just amazed at the marvelous quality they had. Some of them are just really remarkable in their depiction of Native Americans, particularly, which is my interest as an anthropologist.
Now, they really fall into two batches. One is the ones he did in 1851 when he had just arrived in California and was, I guess, on his own doing sketches that he thought he might be able to use for a book. And the other, those are the ones that cover Nevada County, our area. There's some picture of Grass Valley, which is literally a grass-filled open space.
Yeah.
And then there's the second batch that he did on commission, mostly in 1852.
Yeah, actually, the sketches from the Nevada City, Grass Valley area, Yuba River, some of them are from, the majority are from 1851, but I'm convinced, and well, actually I know at least one or two of them are dated to 1852, so, and I know that he made at least two trips up into the Yuba River, Nevada City area, both in 1851 and 1852. So I suspect, and I can't prove this, but I suspect that the more preliminary sketches are from 1851. For example, there's a couple of some of the gold camps along the Yuba River, and those I'm pretty sure are from 1851, whereas I suspect that the more finished drawings, the one of Grass Valley that you mentioned, and S.P. Storms, and so on, that those may very well have been done in 1852, because I believe he was, well, first the Grass Valley sketch, of course, ended up in the hands of Bartlett at the John Carter Brown Library, and obviously were done on commission, so they date to 1852.
The earlier ones are quite interesting. I would say the later ones, especially the three or four of the interiors and exteriors of native dwellings, are absolutely stunning.
Yeah, they are. They're not only visually stunning, but they're unique. I know the word unique is it's a little dangerous, because just about the time you say, well, this is a unique historical document, somebody finds something new in an archive somewhere, and you know. But in this case, I'm convinced that these are unique, both in terms of their the time period and the subject matter, and also in the way in which he was dealing with Native people. I mean, this is a time when the usual, it's sort of what I call the Indians attacking the wagon train genre of very stereotypical pictures of Native people, and They come off either as, bloodthirsty savages, or, as was unfortunately often the case up in the gold country, as almost homeless refugees. But Brown was, obviously had great empathy for the people he was drawing. He depicts them as individuals, and he is depicting them as they were, at a time when they were still living their original way of life, rather than and of course some of the people that he was depicting probably were within a few months he could not have drawn the pictures he drew, because some of those people were probably dead. I mean, around, for example, Shasta City, there were some very unpleasant incidents shortly after Brown was there, where quite a number of people, Native people, were killed.
Now, he seemed to have had a obvious, you say, empathy, but he also spent a fair amount of time among the various Native groups because he, in addition to his drawings, he was also making vocabulary lists.
Yes. This, of course, was at the behest of John Russell Bartlett. Perhaps just a little bit of background might be in order here to explain who Bartlett was. In 1851, a commission was created by the U.S. government to redraw the boundary between the U.S. and Mexico. And Bartlett, who was a marvelously interesting man in his own right, he was a linguist, an ethnologist, a historian, a man of many facets, and he was placed he was in charge of the Boundary Commission, and he was also a very fine artist in his own right. And anyway, the commission crossed from the east side of Texas across to San Diego, and then Bartlett came up to San Francisco, and he intended, it was in his intention to get into the interior, and he was very interested in Indians and languages and so on. And he intended to get into the interior, but he was so involved with the Boundary Commission business that he did get to Napa Valley briefly, but that was about it. So fortunately, he met or re-met, I'm not absolutely sure, Henry Brown shortly after his arrival in San Francisco, and hired Brown basically to make this trip up the Sacramento River to Shasta. And one of the things that that Bartlett was really interested not only in the artwork and so on, but also he was very much of a linguist, and he himself collected vocabularies as they came across, Indian vocabularies, but he also asked Brown to do this as well.
What do you glean from, as I said, especially the pictures of the, not of individuals, but of groups inside and outside their dwellings? Not only are they stunning art, but anthropologically and historically, they must be incredibly valuable. What do you get from them?
Well, gosh, first, they are, as I mentioned, they're unique in that they are the only depictions we have of either of the interior of, there's one of a Patwin house near Colusa, for example, that showing a family inside their house. That is, there are only three depictions of the interior of Native American structures in California prior to the advent of photography. There's one was drawn by Tikhonov, one of the Russian artists, of the interior of a Coast Pomo house, Coast Miwok, I'm sorry, Coast Miwok house near, on the coast there, north of San Francisco. And then there was another one that was done in the 30s by an English artist showing the interior of a sweat house. But other than that, I mean, Brown, so that we have, this is the second interior house, and this is the only, the other one is the only depiction we have of the interior of a ceremonial dance house. And they're the only pictures we have from the Sacramento Valley, not only showing the interior, but also, I mean, the only pictures we have from that time period of anything like that in the entire, all of Central California. So they're ethnologically just tremendously exciting. They show, for example, the one of showing the interior of the Pat Wynn house is just remarkable, and there's all shows you. I mean, not only the structure, the architecture of it, but how the family lived within it in terms of how space was utilized. It shows there's the raised bedsteads, which we didn't know where they had. We knew that the Chumash in Southern California had them, but we didn't know this. They were very similar kind of thing, sort of a raised platform that people slept on, nets draped to dry, possibly fishing nets or bird catching nets. I mean, there's just so much detail and information in these drawings. It's just amazing.
And all the photographs, early photographs I've seen of Indian dwellings are essentially above ground. And in this case, the ceremonial lodge and some of the summer dwellings are above ground, but the permanent ones are largely subterranean.
Well, they're sort of, I think, semi-subterranean.
Right.
They would excavate a dig a pit, maybe 5 or 6 feet deep, and then they would create a log or post structure within that, and then with smaller logs forming the sort of a sloping side and roof, and then this was covered with probably with brush and so on, and finally the dirt from the excavation would be sort of put over to create insulation, and these were strong enough so that, in fact, one of the drawings shows families sort of lounging around almost like on a front porch on top of their houses. And in the Pat Wynn case in near Sacramento, they had a little tunnel, sort of like an Inuit igloo kind of thing, but a little side tunnel that went in horizontally, whereas a little further north, they were going, there was a central entrance that served as a smoke hole, but also as an entrance with a ladder that you would go down a ladder into it. So these were, very cool in summer and warm in winter because of the earth that partially covered them.
I have, over the years, toyed with the idea of a earth-sheltered dwelling and usually put it away, but just looking at these makes me want to do it more than I ever have.
Yeah, actually, I think they would make a lot of sense. I believe there wasn't there a fellow down in the Bakersfield area who excavated quite a complex series of rooms. I think you can still tour it today. I've never been there, but I understand that it's it would make a lot of sense in the kind of climate that you have. I'm not so sure about Nevada City. I think the climate there is probably pretty nice, but you get down into the valley and it can get pretty hot in the summer and probably fairly nippy in the winter.
So what happened to Henry Brown after 1852? He spent roughly a year in California and then moved on?
Well, yeah, it's kind of interesting. Fortunately, we know a great deal about his time, the few years when he was in California and then for a short time thereafter. But he sort of came out of the obscurity and vanished into obscurity. I believe he was born about 1816, although it's very difficult to. That's a time period when record keeping was particularly difficult, and I believe he may have been illegitimate, which probably didn't help. But he came to California, ended up working for Bartlett. When he left California, he continued to work for Bartlett for a couple of years. Bartlett was in the process of producing a report on the Boundary Commission. It was supposed to be a massive government, multi-volume report, but because of changes in the political climate in Washington, he ended up having it privately printed. But his book, with several woodcuts based upon the Brown drawings, was published in 1854. And then Brown, of all things, I mean, ended up in Bermuda. And I'm not quite sure how or why, although he seems to have, in his letters to his mother, which are an important source for what he was doing sort of in the 1850s, he mentions his health several times, and apparently this was a problem, and so that may be the reason he went to Bermuda, was for reasons of health. But anyway, he went to Bermuda, and then, of all things, he got a job working for the U.S. consul, who stepped down from his post because of ill health and recommended that Brown take over, which he did. And so Henry Brown was the U.S. consul to Bermuda for 3 or 4 years. And then in 1860, he, retired, or said that his health was such that he could no longer continue. And so the last record I've been able to find is just a brief little note that he wrote to the Treasury Department in November 1860 about his pay. And then he just vanishes. And there's a couple of early biographical dictionary that were done of American artists that were done in the around 1900 that report that list him and say that he died in 1860 in Maine, but I have been unable to. There's no record in Maine of his death in 1860, but I strongly suspect he may have died 1860, 1861. But as I said, he sort of comes up out of obscurity and vanishes into obscurity, leaving only these very fine drawings,
which we can be so thankful to you for finally pulling together into one place.
Oh, I was, absolutely delighted. It's so nice to be able to finally, allow the world to see these pictures, because they are the finest artistic depictions of California Indians that exist, and they are a remarkable document. They also, of course, they weren't just of Indians, but he also did gold camps and scenery and so on. And they are unique. They really are.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I've been talking with Professor Thomas Blackburn, Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at Cal State Polytechnic in Pomona. The book we've been talking about is An Artist's Portfolio, The California Sketches of Henry B. Brown, 1851-1852. It's published by Malky Bolena Press in Banning. Thanks so much for coming on with us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me on.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. For the second half of the program, I have with me two well-known local authors, Max McCann and Louis B. Jones, who have various functions in our community. Maxima is best known as a poet and teacher. Louis B. Jones as a novelist, but also as a teacher. Louis, you've just come back from the Squaw Valley Community of Writers, where you've been working over the summer, and Max, you have some classes coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Just to start out, one of the things we're going to talk about is the difficulties of publishing and information that might be helpful for other writers out in the community, but also just to know the state of the American book business, if you're just curious about that. But first, I'd like to start by talking a little bit about teaching. If you both seem to have rather, I would say, satisfying teaching careers as well as your writing ones. Some writers complain that they don't really like to teach. They would rather spend all their time writing. But I have the feeling that both of you really enjoy your teaching.
I love it. I wouldn't give it up, even if I didn't need it, because it really fills something very different in me. Writing is so solitary that the teaching is really important kind of connection for me. Yeah.
Yeah, I like it. It gets me out in the world and away from myself, and it's a gregarious business, teaching, and writing is such a solitary business.
And Max, you, in your case, it gets you out with your students, and Louis, in your case, it not only gets you out with interesting students, but at least at Squaw Valley with some quite a few other writers.
That's part of the fun of Squaw Valley, is the book business people and other writers get together and sort of gripe about the book business.
Oh. you're not out there trading plot ideas, or
you know what I frequently think of is the, what do they call them, rendezvous, the mountain men who first were exploring these mountains 200 years ago, and they would agree every year to come together again in a particular meadow they knew in Colorado or Wyoming, and then exchange lore of where the bears are and where the fishing is good and so on. And it's a little bit like that, because writers are they're always wandering off remote from the world, and they can and they're shy with each other too, so they get together and compare notes a little bit.
And how does the book business look from this summer's note comparison?
Oh, the book business is thriving. You know, the book business is more lucrative than ever. I kind of became interested in writing in a time now antique, 30 years ago, when I would say not interested in writing, but it became essential to me to write when the book business was smaller and sort of lower profit. And now, as you can see from the multiplication of bookstores and the size of bookstores, I think when I began to be interested in writing, you had to seek out a dark little place under the L tracks in Chicago. This was where you could ask for, and it was scary because it was just, there was one person in there who was a bibliophile, and now on every mall there are stores staffed by kids who don't read, and the cash registers are always going ching 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 in stores of two and three stories tall. It's a very different world, a very different market. So the book business is doing fine, I'm thinking.
But it's not doing so well by authors?
Oh, I don't know. It's hard to get published. There's it all depends on which wind is blowing on you at any given time. And there are plenty of stories still of people getting happily published. Maxima and I are both examples of people right now who have a couple of orphaned books going around that the book business... it's kind of, the book business has kind of split into these, there's now a kind of a small, respected literary book that publishers take a loss on, and a big, tawdry, commercially viable book that they make money on, And in between, there's even kind of a, I think, a confusion where the where there are commercial books that carry that somehow flag themselves with the pretensions of the old literary ones. But in all these, it's very choppy waters. But and I think there's no reason for Maxima and me to lose hope if we keep sending it out and find somebody who loves the book.
You know, Max, is this the first novel you've ever attempted?
Yes.
It's called Sounding the Deep, and I would say it's, although it's very strongly plotted and has fascinating characters and incidents, it's a very literary work.
Yeah.
In that it's almost a third of it is an anthology of poetry. Since it involves a bookstore employee in a small Northern California town, fortunately about 100 or 2 miles north of here, who is in her 40s, divorced, and spends all her time reading, mm-hmm. and memorizing poetry. And so she's constantly quoting to people, and especially to the young man, 18 years her younger, I guess you'd say, who comes into her life. Do you think that, how many places have you tried to place this, or how many?
Oh, I'm only at the beginning at this point, so basically I've only sent it to a handful of agents, and I had been courting a particular agent that I met at Squaw Valley from before I finished the novel, so she was my first choice, and she passed on it, and so now it's out to a few others, and I'm waiting to hear back, and then keep sending, basically. And yeah, I think it's a little bit of a hard book to place because in the book world, it would be called quiet, meaning that it's low on submarine chases and explosions. And so
and even the sex scenes are more lyrical than anatomical.
Uh-huh, right. Yeah. So and because it has these kind of literary references, you know, to poetry and stuff, it's going to limit its readership probably. So, yeah.
And did you let the agents know that beforehand?
I kind of did in my first query letter, and I felt like that was a mistake because I made it too easy to reject the book. So I've changed my query letter now to not say those things. I do say that it's a lyrical book and it's a character study. So I put it in that kind of area, you know, but it's not chick lit or whatever. It's not, yeah.
Although I think it would probably appeal more to women than men.
Yeah, maybe so, yeah.
Although there was quite a lot in it that I found quite fascinating, and I wouldn't say that men would dislike it, but I think women would be more viscerally pulled toward it.
Probably. I mean, one of the sad realities about male and female readers is that women will happily read books with male and female protagonists, and men almost exclusively read books with male protagonists, which I find deeply offensive. But, you know, is more, I think that has to do with, well, I won't go into what it has to do.
Can you quantify that, or is this just an impression? Because I read lots of books with female
protagonists. Well, it's not across the board, obviously. But in terms of book sales, it's more true.
Well, in general, book sales, what we would call literary fiction, is more and more being bought and written by women.
Yes.
Does that make you feel out in the cold?
Oh, yes. but I don't know. I kind of have this hope that the same bunch of people are out there reading as were even reading in 1950 and in 1850, that there's some percentage of the people who care. And then there's always been the penny novel. There's always been the, I don't know if it was chick lit, but because women, I think, all do a lot more reading than men and always have.
Well, way back in the 18th century, novels were considered primarily a female occupation, both as readers and writers. And then it was really only in the 19th century or late 18th century that men jumped into the field. Mm. At least that's my impression.
Yeah, I'm sure that there are histories like that and revisionist histories. And, you know, but yeah, Virginia Woolf might have been a little bit incorrect in implying that women never had a room of their own, because they kind of have, before her time, been welcome in the rooms of editors.
Now, in your case, as opposed to Maxima's, who this is her first novel, you have three highly regarded novels behind you.
Yeah, I had three very good experiences in publishing. They were as lucky as books could possibly be with the reviews and the different subsidiary rights that sold and so on.
And that you can tell that they're all by the same author, but there's a definite progression of style. And
well, that's interesting.
I think of Ordinary Money, the first one, as being sort of like a fairy tale. Mm-hmm. And it is. It's sort of a morality comedy.
It has the purity of that, though,
yeah.
too. It's not quite so fuzzed over with.
Right. And then in Particles and Luck, which I only read, a copy hadn't come my way, and I'm too cheap to buy it new, I'm sorry to say.
Well, you run a used bookstore, so
yes.
You can't avoid
it. But anyway, a copy finally came my way about 3 weeks ago, and I read it, and I liked it. It doesn't have the sort of fairy tale purity. The characters are more complicated. It's a little darker. It's still very comic, but there's more going on. And then in California's Over, it moves even more in that direction. It's much more ambitious and less comic than the first two. But they all were very well reviewed, and did they sell well?
They all did, yeah, very just fine for that market. You know, I'm not Tom Clancy or Anne Rice, except for California's Over, which disappointed expectations for the publishing house. The other two exceeded by a tiny modicum. The small sales that they expect for a book like that.
But your latest novel, you find that they don't want to publish it?
Oh, no, I haven't been sending it out. I think I haven't published a book in 10 years. And some of that has to do with my own ambivalence and maybe withdrawal from publishing. I probably don't want to enlarge on this on the radio, but I'm I don't know what publishing is anymore, or why I need to reassert myself in the world in some way if I'm going to publish. And my withdrawal from the world has been good for my writing. The book you're referring to, I probably finished about seven years ago, and haven't returned to, because I think it's done and wonderful, but I also know the folks in the book business, and I know that I wouldn't want to burden a good-hearted, intrepid editor or agent who has his own problems keeping his job in publishing. I wouldn't want to put him in the position of having to say, as he says to many people, I love this, this is great, but I don't know what to do with it. We can't, you know, these people's jobs are on the line.
So you haven't even sent it out?
I have. I've sent it out to the people that I know and that care about me, and then I stopped because I could just see. It's about Alaska. It's a small book about Dutch Harbor, or on Alaska, which is in the Aleutian Islands, in 1970, in a very quiet time before big oil and before industrialized fishing and before something called the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which kind of made the Alaska natives slightly rich. And it's really about the old Alaska that existed for a minute. And it's a book, because I was there then, and I feel some historian's obligation. I haven't jazzed it up. It's a very unironic story about the kinds of real life situations, and so it's a book that, if it publishes, it would go to some small press. Eventually, I have confidence that it will publish, but it would be someone who is, it would be an Anchorage press or a Pacific Northwest press in a very small print run. And maybe it would be a precious little book for some people, you know, but it's not for New York book business. So, you know.
But then you have another novel that has wider ambitions?
Yeah, I have something that's done that's huge and ambitious. And I think I'm about to begin choosing an agent, because I have to now bestow it somewhere. And in fact, I was at the public library today doing research for my new book that I'm already about 10 pages into. I seem to have to do that. I need to wade into the shallow end to see how it feels and then go to the library and start learning. But this new book is large and metaphysical and kind of funny, and I'm going to send this one out a little more actively.
Okay, I heard it has angels in it.
It has angels, and I take angels very seriously. The Catholic Church's official doctrine is still that there are angels, and a lot of people with no sense of humor at all believe in angels, and I've sort of adopted that viewpoint as much as I can. It's educated me to adopt that viewpoint, secular humanist though I be. It's been an interesting book to write.
In this case, you say you're looking for an agent. That's because you've been out of the field for 10 years and your old agent has moved on? Or?
No, she still wants me to send me her books.
Ah.
So maybe, I don't know, it's all... This is it's like courtship. You don't know which way to go.
And Max is nodding vigorously.
Well, just from the little I know about it, I mean, it's really an intense relationship that you have with the agent, and so it is a little bit of a marriage. And and once you sort of commit to that person, you're handing over your baby to their care. And then you do this dance with them about what should happen to your baby, you know?
Yeah.
And do these other people ever say, well, your baby needs another arm or it's got too many toes?
Some agents do that. And people say the best agents don't do that, but I'm not sure. I think sometimes a smart observer of the book scene and a good reader can give good advice. And I would take my agent's advice if she said, cut that chapter or something.
And then you get more of that from the publisher's editors.
Yes. And, of course, those are the people whose advice you kind of have to take. They're a little bit engaged in the artistic project with you, and they know what they're trying to sell.
Mm-hmm. How much have editors changed your three first novels?
I've always had the same editor, and he's a wonderful person named Dan Frank, and who was first at Viking and then moved to Pantheon, and all my books were edited by him. And... Ordinary Money once had a certain chapter 11 where my two characters went to, it doesn't go from chapter 10 to chapter 12 now. I changed the numbers when I eliminated the chapter. I had my character in possession of a crate full of counterfeit money fly to the island of Curaçao to do some offshore banking. And so for that chapter, my narrative left the little Marin County scene that I had created, and I had him get off a plane on the tarmac in Willemsburg in Curaçao, and I thought that would put some sky and some air and a postcard in the novel. And Dan's the only editorial correction he made was, could you take that chapter out? And as soon as I'd done so much research into offshore banking in Curaçao, and I was so glad when he told me that, because it just felt perfectly right. Other than that, he's never made any changes.
Now, I did notice in the first, Ordinary Money and Particles and Luck, some of the made-up place names are the same, like Terra Linda. Mm-hmm. And then I just didn't realize till I opened Ordinary Money again this morning that this bar, Rumpelstiltskin's, is in both of them.
Oh, yeah.
And so I imagine, were you trying to create a... your own little Marin County? I mean, that you would carry forward from book to book?
That's been happening. I think of it as my Yaknapatawpha County.
Okay. And even though California's Over is way on the edge, it doesn't get involved with things outside of the one village.
I couldn't find any way to squeeze the Alaskan fishing village into Marin County. But the new book about angels is, again, Terra Linda, my lower middle class Terra Linda of the 60s and 50s, where the boy in question grew up. I love that little space.
Yes,
That little freeway exit town, so this new book really, it's like a 700-page book, and it's really deep into Marin County.
Now, Max, your novel, on the other hand, was very tightly into Cedar Falls, this Northern California town, and then all of a sudden, the two main characters take off for Las Vegas, And when that first happened, I thought, what are they doing? This is destroying it all. But in the end, it greatly enlarged their world, their sense of each other, their sense of what was out there around them and of possibilities. Mm. Did you intentionally want to get as far away from Cedar Falls as you could, or?
You know, it was a little bit happenstance. I was invited when I was working on the first draft. I was invited to Las Vegas for a film festival that a friend of mine's film was in, and I really hate Las Vegas. And I had this idea that I needed a project when I was there to make my time bearable. So the project I decided on was to research theme weddings in Las Vegas and choose one. I mean, I had this idea for my characters in the novel that they would go to this really kitsch theme wedding. So it gave me something absolutely wonderful to do in Las Vegas. What I learned from doing that, you know, it did wind up making this kind of intense contrast to the town that the rest of the book is set in, whether for better or for worse. And I've now vowed never to set my novel somewhere I don't want to go for research, because I wound up having to go back to do more research, and that was really painful. So, yeah.
You never got to like Las Vegas?
I really hate Las Vegas.
I've never been there, but I've heard people can like it.
Yeah. So I'm from now on, I'm setting my novels in Barcelona or something. Yeah.
I'll have to remember that if I ever try. We're almost out of time, and we could talk about this for a lot longer. But Louis, you've just come back from teaching. Max, you've got some classes coming up.
I do. Yeah. My fall classes are starting soon, and I just wanted to kind of give a little plug for them. I'm going to do 2 one-day workshops. One that I did last summer called Writing from Connection, which is a day of writing at the Yuba River. We hang out there and basically do a lot of exercises to kind of get people in touch with themselves and in touch with nature and writing from that place. And that's going to be coming up in a few weeks. And it's a 1 day workshop on the weekend. And then another one called Freeing the Muse that will be a lot of very kind of crazy, fun writing exercises that I do, which are good for kind of all genres of writing. So those are 2 one-day workshops. And then I'm also going to be doing my journal writing class. That's an ongoing class. And another class kind of based on the Freeing the Muse, that'll be an ongoing weekly writing class, writing to prompts and giving and receiving positive feedback. So if people want to know about those, they can either call me or email me.
And how do they do that?
So my number is 273-3566. And my email is maxima@infostations.com.
Okay, thanks very much, both of you, and good luck with your novels. It's, we didn't have enough time to really get into this, but maybe I'll check in with you in 6 months and see what progress you've made.
Thanks a lot, Eric.
Toward publishing.
Well,
this has been Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I've been talking with Maxima Khan and Louis B. Jones about the progress of their latest novels. Stay tuned now for Jimmy Carty's Rock and Roll Party. Uh-huh.